Again with Michal. You know Michal from previous episodes, and we are building Stelvio together, and this is another episode of us not only talking about Stelvio, but also about like the stuff that happens in our industry. How's it going, Michal?
Very good, thank you.
I'm good.
Hello,
thank
how are you?
So a lot of things happened. A lot of things happened. We did some progress on Stelvio, so maybe we can just start with that. And just as a reminder, Stelvio is actually a Python framework to deploy your stuff to AWS. And we are basically hitting one of our primary goals quite soon. Would you like to elaborate on those?
Yeah, so last time we talked was, I think, 0.7 release, which was anniversary release. And that was a big one.
Yeah,
a lot of things
of the
there. I will not repeat them. Yeah, beginning of the 31st of January. And since then, we had release 0.8, right? Also 9, or we are working on 9?
I think we are, the next one will be 10, right?
Look at the numbers. Yeah, okay, so we did two releases, 8 and 9. And those releases added more serverless stuff, because as you suggested, we are basically trying to finish the serverless story, what I call serverless story for Stelvio. So, you know, Stelvio has big plans and we want to do a lot of stuff, but we started with the serverless, obviously, you know, Lambda and the related stuff. And we want to really close this story. And we have not much left to do, luckily. So currently we are working on step function, with step function support, which is a bigger piece because it's quite complex, even as the name suggests. And also on porting two more API gateways, because right now Stelvio supports REST API, which is version 1 of API gateway. But in the next release, hopefully, we will have support for version 2, which is known as HTTP API, which is simpler and cheaper. And also
it has support for WebSockets,
API gateway.
Not only HTTP.
Yeah. And this will get us really, really close to actually closing the serverless story, except one little thing, which is Aurora, which is technically serverless
relational database.
Link from the AWS. Yeah, it's a relational database. I think it supports Postgres and MySQL.
At least they are API compatible. Yeah.
Not quite sure, but it changes all the time. But this is what I think is there. But there is a catch. And this is kind of, at one point, it's a blocker for the serverless story, and it's also kind of not sure what's the right word, like a segue into non-serverless story, and that is the VPC, because Aurora technically is serverless offering, because you don't really need to manage servers, you know, you basically are buying kind of like computing units or something, ACU, I think they call it. But Aurora is in VPC, which is virtual private
VPC. Let's look it up quickly.
This
virtual private cloud is it? Of course it is cloud. Yeah.
Cloud. Yeah, of course it's cloud. It's either cloud or AI these days. Okay. but basically, yeah, it's a private like network you have within AWS for your company or your project. So although Aurora is serverless, it requires VPC. And it's a nice, very nice segue for Stelvio, because we need to do VPC to say we basically support everything serverless that AWS offers. But once we have serverless, once we have a VPC, that opens the door to do stuff,
absolutely,
which is not serverless.
Like, it's still true. If you know IAM and VPC, it's like you understand probably 90% of AWS from the core principles. not that you master any of the other services then, but like this is the building block around everything in AWS.
Especially if you are outside of the scope of your project.
So why is that such a hard task to tackle? Like the VPC.
Which one do you mean now? Well, it's a good question. So on the outside, it's relatively simple because you just create, you just create a VPC and you put stuff into VPC and it's all good and everything works when you have your resources in the VPC. When the difficulty comes is from configuration. When you want to, for example, access outside world, because you can have VPC, but that means your resources can have access only to the VPC. But they don't have access anywhere outside. So for that thing, usually you need to configure like NAT gateway or like there are ways around it, because now they also have these connectors which have VPC endpoint or something. The problem is that essentially, if you want to just have everything in one VPC and you are fine with all resources accessing other resources in the VPC, you are good. As soon as you want to have outside access to the outside internet, or you have strict rules around which resources can access what, then you are going into subnets and similar basically setups, and that's more complicated. So that's one thing. The other thing, especially for Stelvio users, is a thing which we called live lambda mode or dev mode. And that's actually kind of hard because what we will need to do is when you will be in the dev mode, we will need to make sure that your computer connects to this VPC, so actually we can still continue executing your code locally on your computer while this code is still able to execute to connect to the resources in the VPC, for example Aurora or whatever else which is in the VPC.
Like the dev mode, we had that for the anniversary release, right? And it's really cool. Like you deploy a stub lambda. And whenever that gets hit, the code is actually executed on your local machine. But as you said, that means that if you want to connect to AWS services behind a VPC, then your computer needs to be part of that VPN or that VPC too. There's a lot of network engineering going on there, I guess.
Yeah, there is. You usually need some kind of bastion or something. So a little EC2 or server which you connect to and then gives you the access. And it's I had spent some time, unfortunately a lot of time, dealing with VPCs in my work, and it was not always pleasant experience. I'm not saying it's bad or that it's like rocket science, it's not, but it's something you don't keep in your head, and because unless you are really working for the big company as a network person, you don't do it every day. So, usually, again, it's not rocket science. You can go to AWS website, you can read everything, you understand everything. It's very logical. It's essentially, it is not complex. It just tells a lot. And then you set up your stuff properly and you work with it for 2 years, and then in 2 years or in 1 year you need to do some change, and at that point you forgot everything you learned 2 years ago. Not everything, but you forget a lot of details and you go back to it, and hopefully we make it in the Stelvio in the way that it will be much simpler to set up and much simpler to go back to it and
so. Got it. Last time we talked, we had the topic of AI and how we use AI internally to develop components, as we call them, for Stelvio. I remember that one large pull request that I did in the attempt of using an AI-only approach, that was kind of a nightmare because like the things didn't work. Is there anything that your workflow changed since then? How are you using AI these days? I mean, it's like 4 months ago that we last talked. So obviously, like, that was Stone Age. what are you doing these days?
Yeah, so, you know, that's what they say, like Stone Age, you know, and stuff changes every week. To be completely honest with you, not much has really changed. So I'm obviously, you know, I'm watching what's going on and I'm trying to like improve my workflow. But nothing significant really, because I was never the person who goes and like, you know, here is a 5 lines of spec and you AI do the job and then I hope it works and I don't look at the code. So I use it every day a lot, but it's more like back and forth. So I don't really use it in the way that like, hey, agent, here is something, and come yeah, back in half hour.
Absolutely.
I always do the iterative process and I look at all the, you know, code changes. And even if I don't, and I maybe I let it auto-accept stuff, it doesn't run for half hour, it runs for 5 minutes or something because I work with small chunks and then I look at the all code changes at once. But I still look at them. So not much has really changed from there. Has anything changed for you? Or how were you? Because I know for Stelvio you did experiment a lot with those PRs. It was for Cognito,
was it
I believe.
Or was it? It could be Cognito. Yeah, I think it was Cognito, yeah. I try to have that spec-driven workflow completely set up. And like I create a lot of time in trying to define steering documents for the AI and then let it build its stuff. And because I had some internal documents that were already like quite narrowed down, I still fell into the trap that AI convinced me that things are actually different than I outlined them. And it completely invented things and workarounds for problems that were just non-existent. I came back to the exact same thing that you described. So I'm using AI as kind of a pair programmer, a lot of rubber duck debugging with AI. But it's not that I rely on 30 minutes, 60 minutes, or even longer agent sessions or something. And I'm really not sure how people who claim to use them actually make any progress. To me, that never worked. That's all I can say about that. Although I got a bit of a feeling on how these steering documents should look like for different models and which intricacies you have to look at to make a model a bit more efficient in what you're trying to do with it. That is a bit different. And then I personally was a subscriber to this Copilot thing. That to me provided a very good value. Like I paid like $40, I guess. I had access to Claude, Sonnet and Opus and the OpenAI models. And they charged by request. So not by tokens or anything like that, but the message I sent was deducted from my allowance, which was pretty generous at 3,000 of those interactive chats. I was probably a good subscriber for them because I didn't have these 30-minute stuff running. I did the math a bit. Like for the $40 that I paid, if I used it like other people claim to use it, that would be probably in the range of $3,000, $4,000, probably even $5,000 in compute costs that they offered for $40. So that had to end. Yeah, I probably don't use that much tokens. What I really find interesting is like having an agent running longer for like debug sessions, running tests again, and really trying to drill down a problem in a very similar way that I would do it manually. It's just like way a lot faster. So yeah, probably nothing has changed eventually in how I use it, but I experimented a lot with different use cases.
Yeah, so looks like we are kind of aligned here. Not like we are not magic AI users who are working on the 20 different projects or agents are working on them.
Well, I find it so funny. There was this picture of people leaving the lid of their MacBooks open, claiming they had agents running. And I think if you don't even know how to deactivate like the sleep mode of your MacBook, you probably should not start agent sessions. But that's a completely different way to look at it.
Yeah. Well, in all honesty, if you really are doing this, you should obviously, run the EC2 and run them there.
Well, probably that's true, yeah.
That would make you can close your laptop. Unless you are working, obviously, on the maybe some UI stuff or Mac thing.
What's interesting, though, is I think subsidies are coming to an end. That's what we see as a broader picture in the industry.
What I wanted to point out. You said Copilot is ending this thing. So what's your take on that? Like, because it doesn't happen in vacuum,
no,
right?
Absolutely not. I mean,
it looks like there is an industry
everyone
shift.
Everyone knew it had to end. And in the beginning, Copilot was like, well, this is this cute auto-suggest tool. And even in the final announcement by Microsoft that their pricing model will change in June, they said, okay, yeah, we started as this autocomplete, autosuggest tool, but it grew way a lot more than we thought. Because Copilot, the plugin or the CLI, that became way more capable compared to the early days when they started, because everyone was laughing at them and Claude was apparently better. But they caught up a lot, at least in my opinion. And this made it unsustainable for them. But on the same token, people are starting to ask questions now. Is that really going to replace us? Because now we have to pay for it. We have to pay gazillions of gigawatts and I don't know what. So eventually someone's going to pay for that. Question is, are we more efficient then?
Yeah, so there is multiple angles or multiple points to discuss here. One is, I'm not actually sure everybody knew that this was coming. And maybe that's just something I picked up, but there was a lot of talk from people, let's just say people, because I don't want to name names because I might remember wrong. There is a lot of like people who talk AI that this is actually potentially can go on because as with everything, the cost will go down. But apparently the cost is not going down as fast as they thought. Or maybe it is going down. But usage is going up that much? I don't know. Like, idea was like, it cost, $1,000 to, let's just go $1,000 for 1,000 tokens, 5 years ago, and then it goes to $100 for 1,000 tokens, just illustrative numbers, and then eventually it should go to 1 cent for 1,000 tokens, right? Or something like that. Like, the idea was that it would go down a lot, like with whatever else. We need, like, for example, with the, processing
time. I mean, there
time,
are,
right?
Again, a couple of angles to that as well. This would be the logical thing to assume because, like, every time in the history of computing, over time, things got cheaper. Well, there's, up until now, there's actually no exception to that rule. Here's one effect that outweighs that a bit. It doesn't neglect it. It just outweighs it because like the demand rises so fast that now we have a shortage on the supply for hardware. I was just looking up like a SSD drive, and I didn't buy it because it was double or even four times the price than I think 6 months ago, something like that. Same is true for RAM. Same is true for GPUs, CPUs. Hardware is just in short supply now because the demand is so probably. Things are getting more efficient and thus cheaper, but on the same page, like demand is like outweighing the potential benefits in the supply chains of the actual hardware. That's one thing. And the other thing is, how do we get more efficient with these? Because like this is actually like if you look at how the LLMs are running, how the inference is actually done, the more or the better value you get is apparently a bigger model. And a bigger model, if you have a model twice as big as another model, that consumes like magnitudes of more compute. It's not just double. There's no linear relationship to that. So as long as we increase the capabilities of those models, this again outweighs any efficiency boost that we might get. Yeah.
Yeah, that is correct. I mean, and even if we disregard whether models can actually think or they just predict, I read somewhere that like human brain is a marvel efficiency in the whole world. The amount of kind of compute the human brain can do related to the energy it consumes, like that's unmatched. And you know, I was thinking just, you know, like the AI is far, far from human brain at this point. Yet the energy efficiency is pretty abysmal, I would say. So maybe it looks like we are actually hitting hardware limitation at this point, right? Because we just, the hardware company just cannot make enough memory or other things to actually build new data centers. And they need maybe more money, more people, I don't know. So these subsidies are basically ending.
I mean, we've seen the same thing for Anthropic, right? They called it an A/B test, but they removed the Claude code from the $20 plan, at least for some users or for some prospective users. So yeah, probably all of this has or is getting to an end. To me, it's interesting that it happens now because I was expecting that to last a little bit longer because we are still in. We are still seeing huge investments, and obviously the big player sees this as a winner-takes-it-all game. So it was a bit unexpected to me that apparently the money is already drying up, or I underestimated the demand, which, by the way, is also the reason why GitHub, not Copilot, but GitHub, the github.com page, faced so many outages. At least that's what Microsoft claims, is we've seen so many more pull requests, so many more users joining, and probably tenfold the time that we had a year ago, and we just couldn't provide the capacities for that.
Yeah, that might be it for GitHub. Certainly there is, you know, a lot of agents doing a lot of you know, pull requests that push or whatever. But I want to go back a little bit into this, like, change of the, it's kind of change of the paradigm, right? Because suddenly there's not going to be, you know, $50 or $100 subscription for a developer. And when I really noticed that there is something really, really wrong with this is when I think it was NVIDIA CEO who who said, if your developer is not spending twice as much money on tokens as is his salary, you know, you are not like doing it. You are not using AI to its potential. And at that point, I was like, that's bullshit. Because I don't know what these people would do. And again, maybe the one who doesn't know how to program in this new world anymore. But like, that sounds crazy because like, if developer, maybe in US, you know, maybe in US, in big companies, developer, you know, make more money than we do in Europe. But like, if they make like 200K, that would mean that person burns 400K tokens
every year. Conservative estimation of 300k, and let's do a conservative estimation of a third of that price is actually pure energy. And now imagine someone burning 100k a year in pure energy. That's insane.
But again, it comes down to like, it's like if the drug dealer is telling you need no cocaine,
yeah, absolutely,
you know, to be good.
That's a pretty good analogy.
You know, obviously, we need to disregard that stuff as a kind of, I don't know, marketing talk for CEOs to big companies like buy tokens, because otherwise you are behind. but what I wanted to talk about is how this cheap end of these cheap subscriptions kind of changes the whole premise of, with, you know, developers will be replaced. Well, will they? Because if you really pay for the token what it's worth, and turns out, especially for these better new models, they are not cheap. Right? So the question is it actually better to hire a junior developer, or is it better to just buy more tokens? Because I don't think the scale of efficiency is 10x. So they say, like, you know, you get the senior developer, you give him a lot of tokens, and suddenly he's 10x developer.
That's not going to happen.
That's not happening. It's maybe 2x developer, maybe 3x developer, if things are done properly.
I mean, we were talking about automation all the time, even before AI. I mean, the whole industry of software is eventually about automation. I'm not an economist, but if you look at these economic models, there's actually, I think it's called solo paradox or something. We can't measure efficiency by technology, at least not by software, not before AI, and probably not after AI. So even 2x could be an exaggeration, but who knows? Probably it's a good tool. I mean, it is a good tool. And the other thing is, well, you mentioned like paying the actual price. What even is the actual price? Okay, subsidies are gone, but are they? Because is the price?
I'm not saying they are. We don't know
exactly
what is actual price. I mean, we the
yeah.
people.
Yeah.
They know the, you know, someone at OpenAI or Anthropic probably
exactly
know what is
so
the,
even
the
if
price.
You're going through the AI,
we don't.
Through the API and not through a subscription. Is that the real price? We don't know. And
maybe it's just less red number than the subscription, but it's still a red number. Maybe it's the price for inference. So they are not losing money on inference. But even if that's true, they are still in the red because somehow you forgot to, or we forgot to think about like what it took to make the model and you know, train the model and all that stuff. So even if that price is priced for the inference, that it's still for the company, it still
sure
means they are in red numbers.
And we
don't
know even less about the Chinese models. I mean, we could like have a very good estimate on how much inference there is, because most of them are open weight, so we can run in inference on our own hardware in theory, and then deduct the numbers from there. But yeah, I mean, from if you're paying them directly, you never know what is actually state subsidy of energy prices and all that kind of stuff. So we don't know what AI costs, if we are honest.
Yeah, we don't know. That is correct, yeah. And that puts all this whole thing into a big question mark. And I don't want to like disregard anything. I like AI. I use AI. I want it to stay. The question is, what's the actual cost? Because that will tell you what's the future, in the sense that, like, are we losing our jobs as developers? Are even juniors losing their job?
Some people,
I'm not sure about that, right? Because some people already mentioned that, you know, giving more AI to developers doesn't make anything better. And this comes down back to like old good software practices, which still I think half companies are not following. So if you have at your company, you know, 3 bad developers, giving them AI will not make anything better for you. Maybe it's not bad developers. Maybe it's just bad culture, because you might have really good 5 juniors and 1 good senior. But, you know, maybe there is a mess in the code base from some old times in the company. You know, there is business people will not give them time to actually introduce good practices, or, you know, to do proper maintenance of the code and all this stuff. And then they go and like, okay, now you have, you know, I don't know, 50K a year for the tokens. Like, you know, that will not do any good until these people get actually time to get stuff in order and follow the good practices. And we all know what they are. Like, most companies are not following most of the practices.
Which raises another interesting question, because those good practices, like good documentation, good test coverage, consistent coding styles, all of these things, they are beneficial to people. They are beneficial to a single developer. They are beneficial to a team. They are beneficial to the culture of a team. And turns out, funny enough, they are also beneficial for AI agents. So
it was even more funny is that what I found out, they are most beneficial,
correct,
to AI agents.
So
because they keep them in the, how to say, they keep them,
correct,
on the right track.
Because that's one thing, because neither you nor me had success in running like 30-minute sessions. We had more success in smaller sessions with tighter guidelines and tighter guardrails. And yeah, for this, you need the things that I mentioned. And I would go even so far and say that in this regard, AI might accelerate the adoption of good practices, because people will start to realize, okay, AI, you can't discuss with AI whether it needs it or not. You either get the results or not. You can discuss with people. We are not doing that here in this company. We are not doing documentation, because we are focused on shipping fast. Good luck telling that to your agent, right? So people might get back, yeah, to the root and to good practices because of AI. Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah, hopefully. And a lot of these things, the AI makes
yeah,
easier, because if you have... Again, if you use, for example, when I use AI my way, which is way, and my work might not for work for other people, usually, you know, I discuss the feature, you know, pros and cons, doing some research and so on. It's so easy for AI at the end of that, when I came to conclusion of how this thing should look and work, just tell it to write up documentation.
Yeah.
Right? That's easier. Another thing which is much easier is like setting up all these good processes, whether it's CI/CD and other stuff. AI can help you with that, right? Because it can, you know, you don't have to Google, you don't need to, you know, it's much faster just to put together a GitHub action YAML config or something.
Or just like finding the correct regexes to parse log files and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. So AI can use these good software practices and can also help us to actually introduce them. But it all starts with the people. So you still need right people and good people to work with the AI.
It all starts with the people, yes. I mean, that's non-negotiable. And we don't even know how to use it. We don't know what it costs. We don't even know how to use it. Like I mentioned Stone Ages because last time we talked was a couple of months ago. This is Stone Ages in AI influencer time. But what we are seeing is there's one model, then there's the next model, another tool, another framework, another SDK, whatever, you name it. And this is pretty much the same thing that happened like in the early days of JavaScript front ends, where everyone created their own web framework for whatever. And we seem to have finally settled with something like React or React like syntax and stuff like that. We came all the way from like we separate HTML and CSS and the backend, and now we have like we have React with like inline styles and inline SQL and I don't know what. Apparently that works. I'm not a front-end engineer, but apparently people are using it. But this was a long way till we got there. We tried so many different things from jQuery, Vue, Angular 1, Angular 2, and I don't know what. Not to mention all those frameworks that we don't even remember now. And the same will happen for AI. Because we don't know.
Definitely. Nobody knows what he's doing. That's the thing here. Like whole dev world is doing stuff, and there is no best practice. There is no nothing. Everybody is just trying to get out their way. And in a few years, something will come out of that.
Yeah, which makes this whole stuff like interesting again, because like the whole industry, there was nothing really new before AI for a long time. I mean, then there were some mobile apps and this and that. There was cloud, serverless, okay, but nothing fundamentally changed. And now we are back like in the same feeling at like building your first personal computer, right? Nobody knows what they are doing.
Yeah, it reminds me in the end of 90s, it was, I think. When there was this war between Intel and AMD, right? More gigahertz or megahertz, started with megahertz and then the gigahertz or something. And that reminds me this, like that every 3 months or every half year, there was some new release of the, you know, AMD did 2 gigahertz or, you know, I don't know, 1.5 gigahertz. And then Intel did 1.7 gigahertz or whatever, right? You know. This reminds me this kind of dynamics, like, you know, I have this model and now I have this model which is a little bit better and this model which is a little bit better. But to be honest, at this point, I just wish things would not change that much, because I'm just worried, like, for example, Opus 4.6 works for me. It's good. And there is 7 and I don't see the difference, to be honest. And I'm just worried that the thing might happen as before with, I think, Sonnet 3.7 was much worse than 3.5. Now I'm afraid the new model will be worse and they will stop providing the old model. So actually at this point, I'm like, please don't break stuff. Just keep it as it is and I'm good. I don't actually, you know, I don't believe in AGI anytime soon. So, you know, again, like at this point, I'm more hoping that things will not change much. Then
I'm not sure if I would share hoping that. I would just say, yeah, sure.
I have a question for you. Do you think the models are actually getting much better lately? Like are the new models dramatically better than previous one, or do you think that the rate of improvement is slowing down?
I mean, the rate of improving is slowing down. That's not even like an opinion. We see that in these benchmarks. Of course, they are not 100% objective, and probably some of the stuff is going into the training data. This is a whole different discussion, but there's only slight improvement. Not so sure about Mythos, but I think there is this name is already telling.
Yeah, exactly. And the name is telling. I think the Mythos might end up being like, you remember there was this old TV series, Colombo?
Just one more thing.
So the Mythos might end up as a Colombo's wife.
Probably, yeah.
And we don't know if actually she existed.
But what I do see is an improvement in the workflows when I use different tools to steer those LLMs. And I think this is, there's so much analogies to the early days of like when the internet started and stuff like that, the role of Microsoft. We see a lot of those patterns with Anthropic and OpenAI. For example, when it comes to coding agents, Anthropic is, okay, you have your Claude Code subscription and you cannot use it for any other coding agent than Claude. So this is kind of a very walled garden situation. And I think that's because the same reason that Microsoft had, okay, a computer is definitely a piece of technology that comes with Windows. They say, okay, a piece of, or using AI for coding is definitely something that should come with Claude. And the reason for this is probably exactly the same. As we just discussed, the models aren't getting significantly better. But the tooling is the one that people, or that sticks to people in a way. For example, I also have that Kiro subscription, this Amazon VS Code fork thing. They use some open source models. They use some Anthropic models, the older versions. I think the newest that you can get is Sonnet 4.5. You cannot even get Opus on Kiro as far as I remember. But the results are so good that I don't care. I use the model selector always on auto suggest in Kiro because I don't care about the model, because the harness in that way is so good that it somehow works with anything they offer. So yeah, probably that's, and again, that's the analogy to the web frameworks. The tooling around it will improve significantly more than the model itself. That's at least what I think.
And that's a good news, because again, I think we, I don't want to say we're approaching the kind of ceiling for the models, but definitely it's not going to be AGI. Time soon. So what we can improve is the tooling. And if the tooling will get much better, while the models will not get much better, then it's actually pretty good for developers. Because, you know, you will always be able to get open source version of whatever tooling.
Then you just need
open source version of the tooling.
GPU. Which are hopefully at some
yes
time.
Yes and no, because you can always get one of these Chinese models or whoever makes them, right? So, like, I still haven't tried, but I really want to try this Minimax, and there is this GLM, and I don't remember all the names. According to the benchmark, they're like slightly behind the state-of-the-art models. So if you give me Chinese model, which is 90% there compared to Opus Codex, I pay, I don't know, $3 or $150 for million tokens instead of $30 or $90, what I might get charged from Anthropic if they cancel the subscription plans.
Sure.
No brainer. And maybe that is actually a world which we might end up with.
Probably. I think
I don't need smarter models. No. I don't know. I'm not saying it will be good if they will be smarter, but at this point, I don't need them. The current models, I can steer them in the way, you know, I do research separately, some designing, and then I keep them in a very narrow track with a limited scope what they need to do, and they work pretty well.
And the question now is, if you could have a less narrow track, wider track, if those models were actually more quote-unquote intelligent?
I don't know, because the one problem obviously is the context, because one thing we are discussing here is like intelligence of the model, and even if that might go up a lot, it doesn't help if the context doesn't go up a lot.
Right,
because to give model a wider, more complex, long running task, I need more context. But we all know that it starts to suck a lot. I noticed that, for example, Opus 4.7 is still not totally stupid after 200k. So, but after 300k of used context, it's
and
going
that's
down
well
pretty
within,
fast.
We are not talking compaction here. That's well within their advertised context size.
Well, the context has a million,
K or
right?
A million even? A million, okay.
No, million. I'm using the old Opus 4.6, the original one, had a context of 200K. And for me, it started to go pretty stupid after 150.
Same for me. I mean,
it was like, so these one are improvements. These 1 million context models are better in the sense that I can go past 200K and it's usually not getting much worse, but it is getting much worse approaching 300K. But there is no way I can use a context window of 1 million, because at 500,000, it will probably be totally dumb, making up stuff up, you know, not to mention what would happen after, you know, closing 2 million. I never even got there because they would be just total waste of my time.
At this point, I see context size as like marketing speak, in the same way I see megapixels on a smartphone camera. I mean, 2 million megapixels or 20 gazillion, I don't know, that doesn't make me a better photographer. And that doesn't make the chip better.
Yeah, especially if you have bad optics, it doesn't help at all.
The chip better.
That's the thing.
And
this is similar, but again, I'm not saying improvement. There has been improvement because now it's somewhat useful after 200K. Not much after, but a little bit. Before it was not useful after 150. So there is improvement. I don't know. There is no million context.
Absolutely not.
It's not. And that brings me back to your question. If I would want model to take over bigger task, and I don't know, because I don't want to outsource the thinking. And I read something on X. Someone was posting something that you can actually outsource thinking, but you cannot outsource understanding. But in my view, it's kind of the same thing. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe I'm willing to outsource thinking in the sense that I don't want to think about how this specific function works inside. I'm happy to outsource that, right?
Or find the right entry points or the right logs.
Or choose the whatever sorting algorithm works here. I don't know. So I'm happy to outsource that, but in my view, that's not thinking, because that's not what I'm paid for. I'm not paid for variety functions. It was maybe when I was junior 20 years ago, but I'm paid for finding solutions and designing the systems. And even if model could do that, what would be the benefit for me because then I would still need to come and understand.
And
usually understanding complex system is actually not much faster than actually designing complex system.
Yep.
So I'm not really interested here.
A little anecdote here. I do also have a subscription for Perplexity, which is quite good actually.
It's like the search,
They have a very good tooling for crawling the web. So you can give it research tasks and it performs really, really well, even better than the Google Gemini things. At least for me, you can pick the models as well. Given that everyone is building their AI SDKs and tools now, I try to figure out what these tools do, what their USPs are, how they compare. So I made a list of a bunch of GitHub projects, put it into Perplexity and say, okay, now create me a comparison table. Well, I did a bit more instruction than just get me a comparison table. I put effort in, okay, find the differences, the main things. So it was quite a lengthy prompt. But the result, even after several attempts, was, well, close to useless. There were right facts in there. The number of GitHub stars, the implementation language, which 90% was TypeScript. But there was not something that helped me understand how those projects would relate to each other. And I specifically asked for that. So the understanding part is absolutely not even remotely in reach at this point.
Yeah, because again, I think it comes down to the thinking, right? Because to think, you need to understand. And these are not thinking machines or understanding. These are basically predictions machines. And it can get very, very useful for some tasks. It has a limit of comprehension which humans have. These machines absolutely just don't.
On the other hand,
which again doesn't make them
absolutely
bad.
Not.
It just you need to know the limits of what task they excel at and what task there is pretty, steep cliff down where they are not useful.
One way I look at this is AI will contribute to our industry being more industrialized in a way that exactly that happens now. We are, a couple of years ago, we were sitting there like cavemen and typing code by hand, doing all the thinking and having Stack Overflow in the other tab, but nonetheless, everything was manual. And now we are reaching a point where this craft becomes like a design, like the stuff that larger enterprises do. It becomes a design document, it becomes a requirements document, becomes a task list, and then the implementation, which, by the way, never has been the limiting factor, because all the other previous items, they were and still are the limiting factor. And, we get kind of predictable results. Okay, there are still stochastics in a way that we cannot, it's not deterministic what comes out of an LLM, but it's kind of predictable if we have the right steering documents. And so coding like a caveman probably will not happen again in that regard. In the same way IDE
probably not
ways IDE changed the behavior of people, Lintas changed it and now AI changes it, the implementation or the actual coding, the programming part, the hitting keys on your keyboard. That
would actually say there used to be this, what's the difference between coder and programmer? Or maybe this is, you know, these like coder just writes the function and programmer needs to kind of think and
what's
design
the developer or an engineer then.
So the actual coding, which is outputting the code, should not be done by people anymore. But everything else mostly still should be done by developers. And it's so in this sense, the AI is kind of like a big machine in a big factory. We can all say human crafted furniture is better, nicer, it has a soul and all of that. And you can appreciate a good table done by hand by someone you know. Yes. But you would not pay for that because that table would not cost, you know, $200 or 100 euros or even for the good ones. That table would cost much more. And you would not want to pay that. And that's why we have industrial machines in the big factories producing furnitures or whatever, or cars or whatever else. Yes, it's not art, it's not craft. But you want the thing and you are not willing to pay more. And similar with the software. So yes, you can have handwritten library or software. The only thing I would say is that from the table, as a physical thing, you kind of can know the difference if it's done by hand. I'm afraid in the software, you even lose that. Like there is no benefit for the user of the result, in this case software, if it's done by hand. Well, at least with the table, you can appreciate the little details. You can appreciate little imperfections. But in software, that's actually not even true.
Actually, those ornaments is actually something you don't want to have in your software.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so that's IKEA-ization of software development then. And we can finally... Yeah?
Sort of. But again, like IKEA, nothing against IKEA, is kind of the taking this into extreme. Like there is a lot of very good, for example, Italian furniture, which is much, much expensive than IKEA. It's still done by machines and it's just better because it's also much more expensive. But it's still not done
just
by
better
hand.
Materials.
Right? So there will always be worse and better, but it's more expensive. But it's still cheaper than if I paid 5 people actually building my closet. And they would need to do it for, I don't know, 3 weeks. I would never pay for that because that would be a lot of money.
Yes, absolutely.
But I can still pay if I want, I don't know, I'm fan of tables. I can still pay 2,000 euros for the table because it will have Italian design, but it will still be done by
the
machines.
There's a lot of...
Right? IKEA is extreme because they also kind of... it's really scaling stuff, right? So obviously Italian, good Italian brand, for example, will make, I don't know, 1,000 tables a year or 1,000 tables a year. IKEA makes probably 10 million tables a year, right? So, but it's still machine.
Well, on the other hand, that's true for software as well, right? If you have like a demanding application, let's say you stream videos to millions and billions of viewers, that might require more engineering than if you have, I don't know, a WordPress website for your local flower shop or something. Yeah,
definitely.
So, AGI not going to happen.
Well, future is long, as they say. I don't see it coming anytime soon. There is also an interesting video somewhere on the YouTube. Someone explains why with the current technology or current rumor stuff, it is not possible to happen.
I mean, I'm not deep into the math behind it, but I don't see it like from a logical perspective. From the little that I know about the math behind it, I cannot see it as well. Well,
and I would maybe close up this AI topic that I think what we learned in the past months or weeks is actually good for developers. Yes. Because we are getting real price for the tokens, which is good because hopefully this talk about AI replacing everybody and it's cheap and it's intelligent and all that stuff is finally hopefully going away and we can get back to normalcy in the sense that yes, it is here, it is useful, but you still need people who think, and this is a bicycle for your mind. This is not replacement of the.
I like that analogy. That's well said. Okay.
I think that I just that Steve Jobs said that at some point, right?
Bicycle for the mind. So what's also not going to happen is another episode of this podcast, because from now on, if you enjoyed like us two yapping about technology and AWS, AI, and all the stuff that's hyped at the moment, we are doing that together starting from the next episode. And where will it be, Miha? We agreed on a name.
Yeah, we agreed on the name, and we had quite long discussions and messages around it, and I think you should say the name, because in the end, you came up with it.
On complexity. We had, I think, 100 suggestions from AI, and after reading through them, this was a natural suggestion. So the next...
I think this one was not from AI.
Because we had 100 suggestions from AI, and then we read through them, and then... Why don't we just call it complexity? So it's complexity.fm.
Yeah. I don't even think that's how it went. I think you just said his word complexity in some sentence or something, and then it hit you like complexity.
I don't remember the details. But the details are sometimes too complex. So we
just need to take note that the human came up with
that. We want to stress that. podcast names for humans or something, or by humans in that case. Okay. We start either next week or the week after. We will again have guests from time to time, but now they are facing like both of us asking stupid questions, not only me. I hope that goes well, and we can reduce a little bit of the complexity in tech.
Yeah, hopefully. That's our business, right? As a developers, we need to take complex problems, take complexity, and come up with the solutions to solve it.
So, see you next time on complexity.fm.
Thank you. See you next time.